Nicholas's meeting with the lawyers took place the next morning in the library of Quentin Park. It was not an easy nor a pleasant session, but then he never expected it to be. This had been the year in which his world began to fall to pieces around his head. He gritted his teeth as he remembered how the year had opened with that fatal moment of fatigue and inattention at midnight on the icy motorway, and the blinding headlights of the truck bearing down on them. He had not recovered from that before the next brutal blow had fallen. This was the financial report of the Lloyd's Insurance Syndicate, on which Nicholas, like his father and grandfather before him, was a name. For half a century, the family had enjoyed a regular and substantial income from their share of the syndicate profits. Of course, Nicholas had been aware that liability for his share of any losses that the syndicate suffered was unlimited. The enormity of that responsibility had weighed lightly, for there had never been serious losses to account for, not for 50 years, not until this year. With the California earthquake and environmental pollution claims awarded against one of the multinational chemical companies, the syndicate's losses had amounted to over £26 million. Nicholas's share of that loss was £2.5 million, some of which had been settled, but the rest was due for payment in a little over 8 months' time, together with whatever nasty surprises next year might hold. Almost immediately after that, the Quentin Park's estate's crop of sugar beet, almost 1,000 acres in total, had been hit by Razormania, the mad root disease. They had lost the lot. "We will need to find at least £2.5 million," said one of the lawyers. "That should be no problem. The hall is filled with valuable items. And what about the museum? What could we reasonably expect from the sale of some of the exhibits?" Nicholas winced at the thought of selling the Ramesses statue, the bronzes, the Hammurabi frieze, or any item of his cherished collection at the hall or the museum. He acknowledged that their sale would cover his debts, but he doubted that he could live without them. Almost anything was preferable to parting with them. "Hell no," Nicholas cut in, and the lawyer looked across at him coldly. "Well, let's see what else you've got," he continued remorselessly. "There's the dairy herd." "That'll bring in 100,000 if we're lucky," Nicholas grunted. "Leaves only 2.4 million to find. And your racing stud?" The accountant came into the conversation. "I have only 6 horses in training. Another 200 grand? Nicholas smiled without humour. "Brings us down to 2.2. We're getting there, slowly." "The yacht?" suggested the youngest lawyer. "It's older than I am," Nicholas shook his head. "Belonged to my father, for heaven's sake. You probably wouldn't be able to give it away. Sentimental is the only value it has. My shotguns would be worth more." Both lawyers bent their heads over their lists. "Ah, yes, we have those. A pair of Purdy side-lock ejectors in good condition. Estimate 40,000. "I also have some second-hand socks and underpants," Nicholas admitted. "Why don't you list those also?" They ignored the jibe. "Then there is the London house," the elder lawyer went on unperturbed, inured to human suffering. "Good address. Value 1.5 million. "Not in this financial climate," Nicholas contradicted him. "A million is more realistic." The lawyer made a note in the margin of his document before going on. "Of course, we want to avoid, if at all possible, putting the entire estate up for sale." It was a hard and difficult meeting which ended with nothing definitely decided, and Nicholas feeling angry and frustrated. He saw the lawyers off, and then went up to the family quarters to take a quick shower and change his shirt. As an afterthought, and for no good reason, he shaved and splashed aftershave on his cheeks. He drove across the park and left the Range Rover in the museum car park. The snow had turned to sleet, and his bare head was sprinkled with cold droplets by the time he'd crossed the car park. Rayan was waiting in Mrs. Street's office. The two of them seemed to be getting along well together. He stopped outside the door to listen to her laughter. It made him feel a little better. The cook had sent across a hot lunch from the main house. She seemed to believe that a substantial meal would keep this foul weather at bay. There was a tureen of thick, rich minestrone and a Lancashire hot pot, with a half bottle of red burgundy for him and a jug of freshly squeezed orange juice for her. They ate in front of the fire, while the rain whipped against the window panes. While they ate, he asked her to give him the details of Duryad's murder. She left out nothing, including her own injuries, and drew back her sleeve to show him the dressing over the knife wound. He listened intently as she told him of the second attempt on her life in the streets of Cairo. "Any suspicions?" he asked, when she had finished. "Anybody you can think of who might be responsible?" But she shook her head. "There was no warning of any kind," she said. They finished the meal in silence, each of them thinking their own thoughts. Over the coffee, he suggested, "All right, then, what about our agreement?" They argued back and forth for nearly an hour. "It's difficult to agree on your share of the booty until I know just what your contribution is going to be," Nicholas protested as he topped up their coffee cups. "After all, I'm going to be called on to finance and conduct the expedition." "You'll just have to trust that my contribution will be worthwhile. Otherwise, there will simply be no booty, as you call it, at all. Anyway, you can be certain I'm not going to tell you one thing more until we have an agreement and have shaken hands on it." "Bit harsh?" he asked, and she gave him a wicked smile. "If you don't like my terms, there are three other names on Duryad's list of possible sponsors," she threatened. "All right," he cut in with a contrived look of martyrdom. "I agree your proposal. But how do we calculate equal shares?" "I shall choose the first item of any archaeological artifacts we are able to retrieve, and you the next, and so on, turn about." "How about I choose first?" He raised an eyebrow at her. "Let's spin for it," she suggested, and he fished a pound coin from his pocket. "Call?" He flipped the coin, and while it was in the air, she called, "Heads." "Damn," he exclaimed, as he retrieved the coin and shoved it back into his pocket. "So you get the first choice of the booty, if there ever is any." He held out his hand across the lunch table. "It'll be yours to do exactly what you want to do with it. You could even donate it to the Cairo Museum, if that is still your particular aberration. Deal?" he asked, and she took his hand. "Deal," she agreed, and then added, "Partner." "Now let's get down to it. No more secrets between us. Tell me every detail that you have been holding back." "Bring that book," she pointed to the copy of River God, and while he fetched it, she pushed the dirty dishes aside. "The first thing we should go over is the sections of the book that Duryad edited." She turned to the last pages. "Here, this is where Duryad's obfuscation begins." "Good word," Nicholas smiled. "But let's keep it simple. You've obfuscated me enough already." She did not even smile. "You know the story to this point. Queen Lostris and her people are driven out of Egypt by the Hyksos and their superior chariots. They journey south up the Nile until they reach the confluence of the White and Blue Niles, in other words, present-day Khartoum. All this is reasonably faithful to the scrolls." "I recall. Go on." "In the holds of their river galleys, they are carrying the mummified body of Queen Lostris's husband, Pharaoh Mamos VIII. 12 years previously, she has sworn to him, as he lay dying of a Hyksos arrow through his lung, that she would find a secure burial site for him, and that she would lay him in it with all his vast treasure. When they reach Khartoum, she determines that the time has at last come for her to make good her promise to him. She sends out her son, the 14-year-old Prince Memnon, with a squadron of chariots to find the burial site. Memnon is accompanied by his mentor, the narrator of the history, the indefatigable Taita." "Yes, okay, I remember this section. Memnon and Taita consult the black Shiluk slaves they have captured, and on their advice decide to follow the left-hand fork of the river of what we know as the Blue Nile." Rayan nodded and continued the story. "Yes. They travelled eastwards and were confronted by formidable mountains so high that they were described as a blue rampart. So far, what you read in the book is a fairly faithful rendition of the scrolls, but at this point," she tapped the open page, "we come to Duryad's red herring, in his description of the foothills." Before she could continue, Nicholas interjected. "I remember thinking when I originally read it that it didn't accurately describe the area where the Blue Nile emerges from the Ethiopian islands. There are no foothills. There is only the sheer western escarpment of the massif. The river comes out of it like a snake out of its hole. Whoever wrote that description doesn't know the course of the Blue Nile. Do you know the area? Rayan asked, and he laughed and nodded. When I was younger and even more stupid than I am now, I conceived the grandiose plan of boating the Abay Gorge from Lake Tana down to the dam at Rosiris in the Sudan. The Abay is the Ethiopian name for the Blue Nile. Why did you want to do that? Oh, because it had never been done before. Major Cheeseman, the British consul, had a shot at it in 1932 and nearly drowned himself. I thought I'd make a film and write a book about the voyage and earn myself a fortune from the royalties. I talked my father into financing the expedition. Ah, it was the kind of mad escapade that appealed to him. He even wanted to join the expedition. I studied the whole course of the Abay River, not only on maps. I also bought myself an old Cessna 180 and flew down the gorge, 500 miles from Lake Tana to the dam. As I said, I was 21 years old and crazy. What happened? She was fascinated. Duryad had never told her about this, but it was the type of adventure that she would have expected this man to launch into. I recruited 8 of my friends from Sandhurst, and we devoted our Christmas holidays to the attempt. Oh, it was a fiasco. We lasted 2 days on those wild waters. The gorge is the most hellish corner of this earth that I know of. It's almost twice as deep and as rugged as the Grand Canyon of the Colorado River in Arizona. It smashed up our kayaks before we had covered 20 miles out of the 500. We had to abandon all our equipment and climb the walls of the gorge to reach civilization again. He looked serious for a moment. I lost 2 members of our party. Bobby Palmer was drowned, and Tim Marshall fell on the cliffs. We were not even able to recover their bodies. They're still down there somewhere. Oh, I had to tell their parents. He broke off as he remembered the agony of it. Has anybody ever succeeded in navigating the Blue Nile Gorge? She asked to distract him. Yes, I went back a few years later, this time not as a leader, but as a very junior member of the official British Armed Forces expedition. It took the Army, the Navy, and the Air Force to beat that river. She stared at him with a feeling of awe. He had actually rafted the Abay. It was as though she had been led to him by some strange fate. Duryad was right. There was probably no man in the world better qualified for the work in hand. So, you know as much as anybody about the real nature of the gorge. I'll try to give you a general indication of what Taita actually set down in the 7th scroll. Unfortunately, this section of the scroll had suffered some damage, and Duryad and I were obliged to extrapolate from parts of the text. You will have to tell me how this agrees with your own knowledge of the terrain. Go ahead, he invited her. Taita described the escarpment very much the way you did, as a sheer wall from which the river emerged. They were forced to leave their chariots, which were unable to cover the steep and rugged terrain of the canyon. They were forced to go forward on foot, leading the pack horses. Soon the gorge grew so deep and dangerous that they lost some of these animals, which fell from the wild goat tracks they were following and plunged into the river far below. This did not deter them, and they pressed on at the orders of Prince Memnon. Yes, I can see it exactly as he describes it. It's a fearsome bit of countryside. Taita then describes coming to a series of obstacles which he describes as steps. Duryad and I could not decide with certainty what these were, but our best guess was that they were waterfalls. No shortage of those in the Abay Gorge either, Nicholas nodded. Now, this is the important part of his testimony. Taita tells us that after 20 days' travel up the gorge, they came upon the second step. It was here that the prince received a fortuitous message from his dead father in the form of a dream in which he chose this as the site of his own tomb. Taita tells us that they travelled no further. If we are able to determine what it was that stopped them, that would give us an accurate measurement of just how far into the gorge they penetrated. Before we can go any further, we will need maps and satellite photographs of the mountains, and I will have to go over my expedition notes and diary. Nicholas decided. I try to keep my reference library up to date, and so we should have satellite photographs and the most recent maps on file here in the museum. If they are, Mrs. Street is the one to find them. He stood up and stretched. I'll dig out my diaries this evening and read over them. My great-grandfather also hunted and collected in Ethiopia in the last century. I know he crossed the Blue Nile near Debra Marcos in 1890-something. I'll get out his notes as well. They're preserved in our archives. The old boy may have written something there that could help us.